You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
In some of my songs, I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Today is Tuesday, June 28th, 2011. I'm Jimmy Carbone, your host from Jimmy's Number 43. Beer Sessions Radio is sponsored by GreatBrewers.com. Learn more about beer styles and all types of beer education. Visit GreatBrewers.com. We're also supported by the people at the Good Beer Seal, an association of 34 New York City beer bars that serve, promote, and support good beer. Check out GoodBeerSeal.com. My co-host Ray Dieter is not with us tonight, but we're going to raise our glass and toast to him, to Ray. We got two of your favorite beers here, buddy. We've got Fuller's London Porter, which has a pretty good beer. What do you guys think about the Fuller's
London Porter? For the Anglophile, Ray.
Yeah,
Anglophile.
Exactly. It's the perfect English porter.
You like it?
Oh, yeah. Always.
Yeah, it's kind of a classic. Mm-hmm. And we also have some Saison de Pont, which is another one of Ray's favorite beers. All right. Well, we had a recent cider event at Jimmy's Number 43 last week. It's in anticipation of Cider Week. This is going to be the first Cider Week hosted by Glenwood and Union Beer and Slow Food New York City in the middle of October. And I'm here with Dave Broderick from DBA and Jen Schwartman from DBA.
No. DBA.
Blind Tiger.
From tonight, we're all from DBA.
We're all, this is the DBA Solidarity Hour. But, wow. You made some pretty great cider last year, and I tried it up. You had it in Vermont.
Yes. And I didn't make it. Well, we all kind of made it. It was a community thing. We have a big press up in my town, up in Barnard, Vermont. And Randy Levitt, who owns the press, I think it was built in 1911, big hydraulic thing. He opens it up to the town, and everybody can bring their apples and make cider in October.
I love that.
And we had a bunch of our staff from the Tiger come up, and everybody took part, and then we made a bunch of cider from that, some hard cider from that, and some of which you tasted when we did our farm to bar event in November. It was a real farmhouse cider made by the guys that run our CSA in Barnard.
Yes.
And it was pretty darn good.
Completely unfiltered and pretty natural.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little raw, and I love it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A little raw, a little high and out. I mean, the farmhouse ones, especially the way we make it, there's like a New England style that tends to be pretty high in alcohol. In fact, I just cracked some of mine that I made from that batch, and it's up around 10% now.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty. It was really great. I mean, it made me really think about, hey, cider once was the great American beverage.
Yeah.
Maybe it could be again.
And I think, Vermont's really pushing it. I mean, obviously, we have a lot of apples.
That's what Johnny Appleseed was all about, right?
Exactly. And there's a lot of interest, again, in our state to bring it back because it's a local product that we grow. We have a lot. This year, the apple crop's going to be huge because we had an incredible spring. So the state really wants to push that, you know, so there's incentives now to really, so I think you're going to start seeing more and more, cider in the market. I'm hearing also that from people like Guidon, you know, Original Sin, that, there's a lot, you know, because there's so many craft breweries now that there's a lot of people looking at cider as maybe one of the next big things.
Yeah.
So there's going to be
it's
some money coming into it.
It's a great alternative, you know, in the fermented, world. You know, for people who are not quite in the mood for regular beer. But I remember an interesting thing you told me, Dave, about how in the old days, a town's worth up in that part of the country was actually based on how much cider they had managed to stockpile to get them through the year, right?
How many barrels, yeah. One town, I think, had as many as 10,000 barrels stockpiled. Wooden barrels, yeah. So
they were rich.
The story of Johnny Appleseed... What was he planting?
He was actually planting seeds, which means he was intentionally growing hard. I mean, he wanted hard cider, because when you plant apples by seed, you're going to get tart, you know, almost wild apples. You're not going to get like a the same variety that seed came from. That's the way it works. So it's,
for hundreds and thousands of years, people growing apples was used as a hard cider.
Yeah,
base.
I mean, basically all the orchards that you saw in colonial America were for hard cider. I mean, you know, because it's all about storage. They had no refrigeration, so the only way they could keep it and have it later was if they made it hard.
So what do you guys think about Steve Wood? Steve Wood is the cider maker at Farnham Hill. He's kind of definitely outspoken, and he's kind of there's not too many other guys like him in the country making cider.
The Dan Shelton of cider?
Yeah, he's. I'll tell you why. Because he was in last week. He gave a talk about cider making, and he picked a fight with a couple of the other cider guys that weren't. So he says he makes agricultural based cider. So he's first and foremost an apple grower, and he's proud of his fruit, and that's the kind of cider he makes. He doesn't blend in. He doesn't take any concentrate.
He lets his fruit be represented in cider form.
He's not making a beverage. He's making an apple, hard apple.
He has an incredible orchard, and he's
got
some. Yeah, it totally makes sense. He's got an incredible orchard. He's got all these old varietals that you just don't really see around anymore, and he'll do like a single varietal hard cider that nobody does that anymore. You know, they're always blending different things, but everything that he makes comes from his own trees, and he's very proud of that. And it's all about the fruit, like what it shows. And he's got such a great palate. He knows he walks around constantly tasting apples from his trees, and in his mind he's blending all those apples to make a cider. He knows, it's like, oh, that tree over there and this tree over here. He just knows.
A wine blender.
Yeah, exactly the same thing as a wine blender. So he's a total pioneer in American cider for sure.
How long has he been around? Do you know how long he's been
think
commercially doing this?
Since the early 80s.
Wow.
At least. So, he's coming up on 30 years doing this. And it's been a struggle, which is why he gets a little, outspoken. Well, there's a reason for that.
Because if he doesn't stand up for people are going to doubt him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he's pushing a cause.
Yeah.
What are some ciders that you like? We know this Original Sin and Crispin and Dogs. About some of the more artisanal ciders from around?
Well, there's one that comes from the Midwest, and I wish I'd had time to do my research. Scrumpy's.
Michigan.
It's organic. That one, I liked it. It was just, I didn't taste the alcohol, and truth be told, I like to taste the alcohol. But the other ones that have really intrigued me are from Oregon. I believe it's Salem, Oregon. Wandering Agus.
They're friends of
mine. They're great guys. And they dropped off a bunch of samples at the Tiger several months ago when they were breaking into the market. And we've carried a few kegs of their cider. And just recently, we actually had a dry hopped one, which was pretty interesting because hops notoriously don't play any role. I don't know exactly why. Maybe Dave can clarify it. But so I was kind of curious if there would be any influence. And what it did was it dried it out completely. It was bone dry. So you could taste the influence without tasting hop bitterness, really. And people were loving it. It was just completely different from the ones that are heavily marketed to us, which are much sweeter.
I think that's the challenge for cider, is to break out of they've sort of, every place has a cider line, and it tends to be a female fan base, I think. And or at least that's what people think.
It's almost
like
it's almost like a wine cooler.
At least,
exactly.
That's what they're thinking. Refreshing.
And they need to. That's the big challenge for ciders, to break out of that niche and get other people drinking it. And so, I think that they have to experiment with flavor profiles like these guys are doing in Oregon. But that's what people need to start playing with it. And I think as more people get into it, that's going to happen.
It's not easy to make good cider, is it?
No. Definitely
I had
not.
Some friends out in the Hudson Valley just on their own. They were trying to make apple wine, and it was all over the place. I mean, there wasn't one that I would say was good, but they were trying, And the stuff that you guys made, I mean, tell us about that. This was really, your guys were up in Barnard, Vermont. Mm-hmm. They're they're making it as friends, but it's something that you guys trade a little bit. And
yeah, we they use it as part of their CSA, and they put it into barrels, you know, the way they used to do. And everything is like sort of old time Vermont, you know, just bringing things back. And so they, I think last year we had 4 barrels, wooden barrels that we filled. And then they, so it sits all winter in those things in their cellar. So it's cold fermenting, and which slows it down, which is good, because part of the problem with cider as opposed to beer is that all the sugars are fermentable. And so the longer it ferments, the drier it gets, to the point where it's so dry it's undrinkable. So it's finding that that sort of right moment. And they've had a lot of good luck. And so they keg it off in the, you know, each week they keg off some for their CSA pickup. So when you come, it's a big party. And that's how they use this cider, is to promote their CSA. And they're not selling it commercially. But it's pretty damn, I mean, considering that we're sort of doing it half-assed, it's pretty good. And it's basically, a lot of it's naturally fermented, you know, because there's yeasts on the skins of the apples. And so you know, so it can be, that's why you get that up and downness, you know, especially if you go that, or you can use a champagne yeast, which is so, traditional as well.
Yeah. So it's using natural yeast, spontaneous type fermentation.
Yep, sometimes.
I was going to ask a question, like, what would the difference between a cider and an apple wine, like Jimmy was talking about? I mean, would it be yeast strains probably? I mean,
yeah,
because
you're going to have to, it's a lot stronger, so you'd probably have to use a champagne yeast.
Okay.
Rather than depending on natural yeast, which might not survive
right
that much alcohol. So I think, I've never actually made an apple wine, but I've had it, and it's definitely stronger. So they're at least using a wine yeast, if not champagne.
Okay. Got it.
I think. But there's something else different about it. I had a really great apple wine from Long Island not too long ago. And it was, I mean, it really tasted like wine. I mean, it tasted like a Chardonnay. Huh. And I immediately got curious, like, okay, well, how did they get this flavor profile? Because this is really different and interesting. And I could drink this as a great white wine.
I've had some, I mean, there's one, I think they're in New York, but they get their apples from Vermont. It's called Slyboro.
Okay.
It's up by Washington County. And they make a sparkling wine style apple, and they also make an ice wine, which I've had, has been terrific. Mm-hmm. We made a cocktail once called the local, I think we call it the, I don't know what we called it, local something, but we had Applejack and Slyboro cider and some handmade orange bitters.
How'd you feel the next day?
I felt great.
Yeah.
Because
apple's
good.
Natural. It's all about what's natural.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
If it's natural,
no
preservatives, not too much sugar.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, homemade bitters, love that.
Sulfites. Yeah. But listen, I'm drinking the Saison DuPont now.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to drink another one of Ray's favorite beers. And we'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to Hot Grease every Monday at 3:30 p.m. Hot Grease strives to bring sustainability, localized sourcing, and other forward-thinking schools of culinary thought to the minds and kitchens of everyday folk. Each week, Nicole Taylor's conversations cover the entire spectrum of food enthusiasts, from internationally renowned culinary masters to moms on a budget looking to impress their tiniest critics. Again, that's every Monday at 3:30 p.m. Hot Grease on the Heritage Radio Network.
All right. Big shout out to Nicole Taylor, the host of Hot Grease. Heritage Radio Network has over 20 shows from food to farming and cheese and beyond. We love it. We love being on this network. We love the people behind it, Patrick Martins, Jack Inslee, and everybody. So thanks so much for having us, Beer Sessions Radio, on Heritage Radio Network. I'm back with my special guests, Jen Swartman and Dave Broderick from Blind Tiger. We've been talking about cider, and now we're going to move on to small local brew pubs. We've got Penny Pink from Portneuf Valley Brewing in Pocatello, Idaho. Did I pronounce that right? Hey, Penny, hi there. How are you?
I'm doing well.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
Well, we were sitting here just not too long ago looking at a feature article about you in Beer Advocate magazine. And let's tell us a little bit more about how you got started.
Well, it's basically a homebrew hobby that got a little out of control. So
that's how it happens a lot of the time.
Yeah, it was supposed to be my husband's hobby, and he blew up a batch of beer all over his power tools, and I won't repeat exactly what he said, but it was something along the lines of, Penny, you're the one with the degree in biology and chemistry, you brew the beer. So the rest is history.
Sounds like that was a good decision.
Yeah, well, it's worked out better. He's just an engineer and physicist.
So do you think your science background helps your brewing?
Absolutely. I utilize just about everything I've learned from biology, chemistry. My master's degree is in hazardous waste management.
Oh, my gosh.
And I put all of that to work and project management experience. And I can tell you firsthand, brewing beer sure beats managing nuclear hazardous waste.
Is that on your label?
Cheers to that.
if I bottled, it might be. But, yeah.
So you don't bottle. You're just a brew pub?
Brew pub, and we distribute draft beer in kegs.
Got it. How far? Just within Idaho, or do you make
just
it
just within Southeast Idaho?
That's cool.
And what's the beer scene like there?
Well,
what's the town like? How big is the town?
Let's see. How can I put this diplomatically?
What's the name of it again? It's Pocatello. Can you say it? Can you pronounce it for us?
Yeah, it's Pocatello, Idaho. The locals pronounce Portneuf. Mm-hmm. French word, Portneuf apparently was a trapper, French trapper in this area. And the river that runs through Pocatello is the Portneuf River. So that's the name.
What's the main industry?
Well,
aside from your beer.
Yeah. There's a university here.
Oh, okay.
Historically, it's been a railroad town. There's a couple of major interstates that come together here. We have phosphate refining companies on the edge of town, so it had been sort of large, gross industrial plants. One of them shut down, and the air quality has improved significantly since then. We have a semiconductor factory here. Basically, fairly diverse industry.
Yeah.
Demographically, it's basically northern Utah here.
Okay.
So we have an awful lot of folks from...
Overflow?
Yeah, the Utah area. A very large percentage of the population here does not drink alcohol.
That's always a challenge.
You don't have a cap on your alcohol level, though, do you?
No. In Idaho, basically, if you want to brew stronger beer, you're welcome to do that. You just pay wine tax on it.
Uh-huh.
So basically, the excise taxes for stronger beers are three times the beer tax.
Wow. That's
yeah.
a good way to discourage it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's if people want stronger beer, fortunately are usually willing to pay for it. Yeah.
What exactly is considered stronger then? What alcohol level is the cutoff?
4% by weight.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're basically
what's that
making
by volume?
Wine then.
It'd be 5.2 by volume.
Yeah.
So
when you first started, you know, what were the reactions to your beers?
if I had bitter anywhere in the name of a beer,
it scared them.
You know, like nobody would touch it with a 10-foot pole. You know, it was pretty much a Bud Light kind of town if you drank at all. So trying to educate people, I started the business 15 years ago.
Right.
And I've seen a real shift in terms of people's palate. You know, the exposure that people have had to microbrews in their travels and just what's available in the local grocery stores now compared to 15 years ago is just huge. Now I have customers coming in, and it's like, Penny, can't you make this hoppier for us? We want it more bitter.
Yeah.
You know, so it's practically to the point, like, I can't throw enough hops into the beer to please some people.
Now, are hoppy beers your favorite thing to brew, or what's your specialty?
One of the things I try really hard to do is brew a broad cross-section of beers.
Okay.
So I have everything from, like, one of my latest creations is the Penny's Extra Pale, which is essentially a very light, very low alcohol, low carb kind of beer, to my Midnight Satin, which is a cream stout, which is high in alcohol. Probably, I don't even want to know how many calories are in the Midnight Satin. You know, undoubtedly high in carbs and everything else. Delicious, smooth, and then Grog is my India Pale Ale, which is moderately hoppy for an IPA. I've kind of consecutively been boosting the dry hopping on that, and that's had very good reviews. And for our 15-year anniversary beer, I basically kind of threw in everything but the kitchen sink, and I'm doing just an over-the-top, ridiculously hoppy lager called Happy Camper.
Nice.
And if that doesn't make them happy campers, I don't know what will.
Exactly.
All right.
Yeah.
Where'd you come up with that name, Grog? I saw that before, too.
Well, basically, it started with, I mean, Grog's basically a very high alcohol beer. It's typically rum, you know, but it, so it was sort of a takeoff on that. And I don't know if you've looked up the artwork that my eldest son came up with for Grog, but he's basically this Viking character with a huge axe and a giant mug and gauntlets, and
boys,
and he just
boys.
Looks like a Grog kind of guy.
Hey, Penny, so okay, you're there in Idaho.
Yes, sir.
What is it? Say I go to your brew pub and I sit at the bar, I order a Grog. What does that cost me?
$4.
$4 a pint?
$4 a pint, $4 a mug. We have a mug club. Mug club members get 20 ounces in their mug for the same price as a pint.
Nice.
Wow.
Good idea.
What do I have to do to be in the mug club?
Well, it's $50 a
First,
year.
First, you got to get to Idaho.
What's that? Yeah,
First, you've got to get to Idaho. Then,
yeah.
she'll talk
Can't
to you.
Can't be a virtual member?
A virtual member? Well, you know, the whole idea is to get you, you know, at the bar drinking beer. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you first started 15 years ago and the palate, the collective palate of your consumer base wasn't very developed, I mean, what did you do to drum up business and interest if you were a pioneer? Because I imagine that was probably a pretty tricky start.
Yeah. Basically, it took a while for me to kind of get a sense for what people were willing to try,
yeah,
and sort of modify my recipes to where they would
be
at
saleable.
Least the core, yeah, the core of what I had, you know, it was something that was approachable enough that people would try, you know, some training wheels beers,
yeah,
you know. But that having been said, the belligerent ass nut brown, I still brew 15 years later. You know, at that time it was just called nut brown
and
ale.
You brew it the same way.
It's exactly the
That's
same
great.
Restaurant recipe. The Midnight Satin, I brew exactly the same recipe that I came up with 15 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, so
you just might make a little more of it now than you used to.
Yeah,
exactly. And people caught up with it,
yeah.
basically.
So, you know, when I started out 15 years ago, I was subleasing some space in the back of a sports bar and grill that had, 28 taps.
Okay.
So I had eight taps, if you count the sarsaparilla tap for my old-fashioned root beer.
Uh-huh.
We went through a lot of that. So, you know, basically I was competing against 20 other beers in the sports bar. They went out of business in 2002 on the heels of 9/11.
Uh-huh.
The guy that owned the building basically gave me 3 months to get out.
Uh-huh.
I had bought this gutted old warehouse on the other side of the railroad tracks in 1999, and my sons and I spent 3 years gutting it out. So basically, I had to go fairly far into debt to get enough of the building renovated to move the brewery down here to the building where I'm currently at.
Got
in
it.
2002. And I had to go back to work doing what I was trained to do to make enough money to bootstrap my way through building the pub.
Got it. On the, so, in that building, in that old warehouse.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, so basically the first 6 years, I was basically just brewing and distributing my beer to the bar where I was sort of co-located, and then distributing through a wholesaler. It wasn't until 2005 that I finally got enough of this building renovated to actually be able to sell my beers by the glass myself.
Got it.
And it wasn't until 2006 that I was able to make enough money to get the kitchen open to where we have
a
full-fledged...
So it has been a process.
Oh, yeah.
Very,
I mean,
very organic.
Yeah, it's basically...
And a patience game.
Yeah, bootstrapped my way through making enough money. I mean, I worked as an environmental safety and health manager at the Advanced Mixed Waste Treatment Project at a major DOE lab, and everything that I made, I mean, everything that I made as a senior manager out there went into this business. I didn't pay myself the first 12 years I had the business.
So we have, you know, obviously a lot of nano breweries that are kind of boots, you know, they start super, super tiny, making no money, losing money, and then in the hopes that they can obviously do something similar, grow up larger.
Right.
And so there's a lot of that going on right now just because equipment is so expensive. It's hard to get. You got to wait a long time. You know, it's got to be fabricated at this point. So, you know, what size is your, like, how did you do that, like, system-wise, equipment-wise? How did you make that happen?
Have you expanded your system?
Yes, I've expanded. And what I started with, I threw my two sons who were probably late grade school, junior high age, in my 1982 diesel Suburban and drove to Portland and bought a bunch of stainless steel tanks from a defunct soda pop factory and crammed them all into my Suburban and tied them on the luggage rack. It kind of looked like the Clampets from the Beverly Hillbillies.
I hope
coming back from Portland. Oh, yeah. It's hysterical. You know, I mean, I practically, you know, I had kegs stuffed inside of these tanks.
Anything you could fit.
Yeah. You know, shoehorned the kids back in the front seat of the truck and kind of, you know, squoze them in between kegs. And came back and put all this stuff on my driveway and stood out there and drank beer and scratched my head and figured out what orifices to take out and what orifices to put in to turn it into a brewing system. Huh. So it was basically started out as a two-barrel system that I would C-clamp the lids on the fermenters to keep them closed with, you know, basically custom-made gaskets. There were like 37 pieces and parts that had to come off every time I sanitized it and put back together. I mean, just ridiculously labor-intensive.
You must have really wanted to make beer.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
I had
dedication.
A great time. Yeah, it's like adult Legos.
And it's a great story now, too.
Yeah.
Now that you don't have to...
You probably, yeah, I mean, now what's it? What kind of system are you working on now? Same one?
Well, not terribly big, actually. I've bought some four barrel cylinder conicals a few years ago, and a four barrel bright tank out of Boise from Sockeye Brewing, and then Grand Lake Brewing was scaling up, and I bought their three barrel, essentially monoblock. It's kind of a three-tank system, but it's efficient enough that I can brew three-barrel or six-barrel batches in, like, a fraction of the time it used to take me to brew two to three barrels. Mm. So I've also got three seven-barrel fermenters and three six-barrel bright tanks and ten, basically, seven-barrel serving tanks.
Wow! Hey,
that
Penny,
I had fabbed last year.
That is super awesome, and we're definitely going to talk to you again. And is there a website, or how can our listeners find out more about you?
If you go to PortneufValleyBrewing.com, it's all one word, P-O-R-T-N-E-U-F as in Frank, Valley Brewing.
I know you have a cool blog.
You can read all about it.
Cool blog on that, too. One quick thing before you go, and before we take a break, tell us two of your favorite beers that you don't make.
Ooh.
Put you on the spot.
Oh, boy.
Nothing fancy.
I would have to say Deschutes probably has some of my favorites.
Yeah.
Black Butte Porter.
Love that.
And Obsidian Stout.
Yeah, those are both great.
All right.
So nice to meet you over the airwaves.
Hopefully we'll get out there.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Penny.
Thank you. We'll talk to you again, and we may meet you in person. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about beer on Beer Sessions Radio.
Hang on to Mary's stump, dance with the soldiers' glee. Been around so quick. Bones, I gave him a yell, keyhole smacked and all, with a chain link fence and a scrap iron jaw, cooking up a Filipino box spring hog, cooking up a Filipino box spring hog, cooking up a Filipino box spring hog. Spider rolled in from Hollister Bird on a one-eyed stolen man. Recovery row in a criminal underwear brawl. I was naked to the waist with my fierce black hound. And I'm cooking up a Filipino box spring hog.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll give a big shout out to GreatBrewers.com, our sponsor. You can learn more about beer education, take the Great Brewers Test 100 or 20, and check out the Beer Cloud app. Jen, have you ever taken any of the beer tests on GreatBrewers.com?
No. I didn't.
You should.
I should. I think
Jen
I
wrote
knew
the
about
test,
that.
Actually.
I did
she doesn't
not.
Need to take it.
I hate taking tests.
Take the Great Brewers 100 test.
I love to
see if you can beat me. I got a 74. If you beat me, write in, and I'll send you an I Like Beer t-shirt.
Jimmy, that's a C. You got a C.
I'll take
a C
that as
beer.
A challenge.
I got a C.
And not a huge challenge.
And
either.
I studied while I took the test. Because you can go to greatbrewers.com. You can take the test and then have another screen. You can look at, you know, your
hands. You had a bunch of
stuff.
Notes written on your hand, didn't
no,
you?
No, I had two computer. Yeah. I had a computer screen.
It was just like high school for him.
So that's it, greatbrewers.com. And Good Beer Seal, let's give a big shout-out. This is going to be the third annual July Good Beer Month. Last week at Barcade, the Good Beer Seal inducted 7 new bars. We're up to 34. Some
wow.
cool ones like Fourth Avenue Pub and
that was a really fun party
Stag's Head.
That's one of the best
party,
beer
yeah.
parties in New York of the year because it gets everyone together. It's like distributors, it's brewery reps, and then it's a bunch of bar owners who never leave their own bars and get together.
Caves.
So they all came together. It was a lot of fun.
So, Jenny, you brought this really cool beer. What is it?
I brought Evil Twin Brewery out of Denmark. It's a nomadic brewery. And this is a Saison called Ryan and the Beaster Bunny that 12% importers who bring them in were kind enough to share with us. But we had an event for them back around. Actually, the bunny reference was because it was on Easter Sunday, so it was that long ago. And the beers were phenomenal, but it's actually a really funny story because this guy, I can't remember his name, Yeppie, I think, is the twin brother of Meikle, who is McKellar. And I guess I came to find, talking to the people who knew him, that they have this long-standing rivalry that goes back, I guess they participated and competed in the same field and track event or something, and
when
then it's
like
perpetuated
10.
And then they homebrewed at the same time, and then Mikkel started his brewery, and Yeppie started an importing company, and then Meikle started a an importing company, and then Yeppie decided to brew. So now they're just like head to head. And honestly, they both have the same humorous sensibility, and they're both fantastic. I was so happy to be able to report that, you know, they're just as good. So pay attention to Evil Twin.
Yeah, Evil Twin is definitely good. And this is actually, this is totally different from the Saison DuPont that we had.
It's like,
definitely more of a hop finish. And
yeah, I smell it.
And do you have this at Blind Tiger right now?
No, this was really a gift from the importers, but I did hear from them that they're bringing in kegs of the same beer and a few others soon. So there should be like a
12%'s got some new stuff coming in. And actually, I just got a report that McKellar actually now is talking about doing a brewery in the United States. Which makes a lot of sense. He said, you know, he sells a lot of beer here, and it's incredibly expensive because of all the taxes and the this and then that, and the import fees. So
is he going to actually start his own brewery? Because he's a nomad over there, isn't he?
I know. He's a gypsy brewer. So that'll be really interesting. But no, he's definitely have it on a good source that he is looking for a brewery in the United States.
So McKellar and the Evil Twins, and there's an interesting hoppy,
which means his brother, which means Evil Twin will have to do it too. You know, as soon as McKellar does it, that's it.
So there's an interesting hoppiness in this Evil Twin, and that brings us to our next guest.
Oop.
It's Michael Rothman from Atlantic Hops. He's been working hard to get the word out about an event that he has coming up very shortly, and it's the Hop Growing Workshop on July 16th in Tarrytown, New York. Michael, are you on the air?
I am. Thanks for having me.
How are you? I'm here with Dave Broderick from Blind Tiger and Jen Schwartman. And we're all excited. We're hopping about the news that you're this great new hop guy. What's going on?
Well,
that makes sense? No.
Doesn't have to.
About hops.
Doesn't have to. It kind of does.
I got it.
Thanks for having me. We're really about trying to get locally grown hops into the hands of craft brewers throughout the region, you know, the region being the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic for us. So we're trying to get people to grow hops. Yeah.
And it's funny. I actually have a farm up in Vermont, and I've got two hop trellises. I've got 34 rhizomes in. I planted half of them last year, half of them this year, and they're out of control this year. They're the ones that I planted last year. I'm going to have so many hops.
Yeah, they grow like wild.
They grow, yeah. But I went to the NOFA, or I guess it was actually UVM Agricultural Extension up at Von Trapp this winter, the Hop Growers Conference, and then I saw the Atlantic Hops Conference in Tarrytown on the 16th of July, and I was actually planning on attending before I even knew you were going to be on the show.
Oh, okay.
And
that'd be great.
And I just wanted to, you know, so how many acres do you guys have planted there?
Well, we're not growing hops ourselves. What's that?
Are you broke? It's a brokerage?
Or you're just encouraging?
We're going to be putting in a processing facility to pelletize hops that are grown throughout the region. So we're trying to aggregate hops that are grown by sort of small-scale growers throughout the region. Then we would pelletize them and analyze them and package them and then, you know, kind of work with the brewers on the other end.
So what do I have to do with my hops to bring them to you to have them be pelletized?
You have to dry them.
Okay.
So that's one thing that's, you know, if you grow hops and you do, you know, that's a really critical part of preserving the hops because they'll rot pretty quickly if they're not dried in a timely manner. So we want any growers we work with to dry the hops first. And, you know, that's one thing we'll cover up at the course.
At the course.
That's coming up.
And so I actually, a guy came into the Blind Tiger last week, and he has 10 acres planted up in Vermont, up in Ferrisburg, Fletcher.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard about him yet? And him and his partner, Ian, and so they were sort of describing the drying process to me, that it's actually better at a lower temp over a longer period, like 90 degrees for 3 days. Is that
right? If you heat, you know, if the hops get, you know, if too high a temperature is put into the hops, some of the essential oils and some of the, you know, the aromatic properties, the aroma properties that the brewers want and consumers want get destroyed and start to degrade. So you want to be able to dry them without adding heat to the process. So you know, just using an ambient airflow throughout the, you know, over the hops or across the hops. There are different ways to do it, but it does take longer, but that's a better way to, or that is the way to preserve the quality, so that's correct.
Michael, tell us a little bit more. In this Atlantic hops, I mean, you guys are new to the region. I mean, where do people get the hops? And I'll answer that question. It's what? Germany, Pacific Northwest.
I mean, I would say...
What happened? Why hasn't someone been doing this forever?
Well, I mean, you know, is it New York and the Northeast were once the largest hop-growing regions in the United States. New York in particular for the late, you know, the second half of the 1800s, the late 1800s, New York was like the center of hop production in the country. And, you know, one of those great stories of, you know, just people making fortunes and just a thriving industry. There's a lot of architecture you see if you drive up into central New York today that's still there, some old hop barns and stuff like that. But eventually, the industry moved out west to the Pacific Northwest, where it's mostly concentrated right now. That's where all the large-scale hop production is, and that's where I think most brewers around here get their hops. Although, you know, many do get different hop varieties from Europe as well. But so the industry left, and it never really came back for a variety of reasons. But people do grow hops, and hops do grow here. And, you know, with the sort of emergence of the craft beer market in this region, it creates an outlet for, I don't know, craft hops or locally grown hops. And you know, there's a lot of different things going on right now that are feeding into the demand for hops. Or just
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So up until you opening your facility with the pelletizer, what was the closest pelletizer in this part of the country? Because I think of it happening so much in the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
But
I don't. As far as I know, there really isn't one.
Yeah.
There are a couple of individual farmers who are hop growers who have enough hops and have sort of, you know, the real early pioneers who have very small pelletizers and have experimented with pelletizing some of their own stuff.
Huh.
But
do you
a
know
lot
who they
of,
are?
What's
Could
that?
You tell us who they are? I'm curious who's pelletizing their own. Hops.
I don't know if he did it last year. There's a grower up in outside of the Finger Lakes, outside of Geneva, Rick Peterson.
Huh.
He's he's been growing hops for just about as long as anyone around here.
Yeah.
But he may. I know he has a pelletizer. I'm not sure if he's been selling pelletized hops or whole leaf. But a lot of them, you know, at the scale that that hops are being grown at now, a lot of people are able to sell whole leaf hops to the brewers who will take limited amounts and do a one-off kind of a seasonal beer. But we want to try to bring it up to a larger scale where we can get, you know, a large enough supply of pellets that, you know, a brewer could brew something all year round, you know, and we would analyze it and get them what they're used to getting, just grown locally.
Michael, sorry for a minute. I want to just get Dave on this. So, Dave, you said you were going to attend the Hop Growers event that
in
Michael's
Tarrytown.
Hosting.
Yeah.
How did you know about this, and why were you even interested?
Well, another farmer sent me up in Vermont, sent me the link talking about it and said, oh, you know, you should go down to this and check it out. And so that's how I found out about it. And then I followed the link.
So do you, as a farmer, do you think that, and your other farmer friends, you guys think you could make money?
Well, I wanted to ask, like,
Michael,
in terms of, like, what size... How small of a batch do you do? You know, I mean, if I come down with dried hops, I mean, you know, how does it work?
Well, that's going to take there are, you know, a couple of different answers to that. First of all, this is going to be the first year that we're going to be pelletizing. So, you know, it's going to depend a little bit on volume for the year. You know, it's hard with the equipment we have, it's hard for us to pelletize, you know, 3 pounds of hops.
Right.
It wouldn't work. The machine would, you know, machines would pretty much eat it up.
Right.
So, you know, a minimum of maybe 100 pounds, but that's, you know, that's a small amount. For growers that we're trying to partner with, we're trying to encourage people to plant, start with an acre. For growers that we want to work with or that want to work with us in a program that we have, this Atlantic Grower Program. Because
right.
we help growers in terms of material supplies and in terms of technical support to get started and, you know, kind of throughout the process.
So if I have an acre or my friend has an acre and we want to go out and change the world, we should go and start planting hops. Is that a good idea? Yes.
we think it is. We think it is. I think, you know, again, it's kind of to be proven in this area to a degree, you know, from what we believe and what we know from talking to brewers, and there's a lot of demand out there for locally sourced ingredients.
It's interesting because Don Bryant, you know, the CEO, the new CEO of Hop Union, was making a run through here a few weeks ago, and then he was up in Vermont last week, and he was saying that he wants to find and partner with hop growers on the East Coast now. Because he thinks that there's a lot of opportunity here. So he finally has an East Coast representative, Pete Velez, for the first time. Clearly there's something going on here.
Or they wouldn't be here checking it out.
Right.
You've got a market.
Right.
I want to know what are some of the big hop varietals we're seeing being grown out here.
I mean, for now, from what we see, I mean, there's a lot of Cascade. Mm-hmm. In part, it depends on what will grow in this area or what will thrive. You know, a lot of different varieties will grow, but, you know, what's going to grow well.
Yeah.
So you see Cascade, you know, some Willamette, Centennial, that kind of stuff.
The sea hops seem, like all my sea, like Chinook, Centennial, Columbus, Cascade, they're just huge right now at my place. I mean, those just they seem to do really well, whereas a lot of the European, you know, the noble hops haven't done as well.
Yeah, most of the noble hops will not grow very well, but there are like sister varieties that can be planted that should grow, such as Sterling, something like that, and that would, I think, you know, find a demand out there among the brewers.
Right. So, Michael, I mean, back in the we're gonna have to get it out of here soon.
Okay.
Back in the 1900s, up in Cooperstown area,
where
the Bush people were growing all their hops, what were the varieties that they were growing then?
That's a tough question. Have a good answer for that. I mean,
well, the reason that then if you don't know, then we're gonna do a hop show. We did a hop show last year. I'm sure coming up, I'm sure by fall we'll put together another hop show, and that's something you should definitely be on because it seems to be we got a lot more information a year later than we did a year ago.
And plus after the conference too, I'd love to hear how that went.
Yeah, we're
and
looking
what comes
forward
out.
To that.
Right, right.
So Dave, plug that for us again. When is it?
July 16th. Well, actually, Michael, you can tell you about it.
It's a course. You know, it's a little different than a conference. This is a full-day course. It's a lot of technical information on how to grow hops, how to dry, but also stuff on the marketing and, you know, the whole industry. You know, it's a very inclusive, information-intensive day. It's July 16th from 8:30 to 4:30 in Tarrytown, New York.
And is there a website
that's
that
a Saturday.
We can find
is that
out?
A Saturday?
That's a Saturday, yes.
Is there a website, Michael?
Yep, our website, www.atlantichops.com. There's information about it there.
Excellent.
And about
Michael,
us, so.
Thank you so much. We will definitely talk again. And now, Jen, we're going to go down to the Good Beer Seal Bar events. Jen, you got a special tour coming up next week. Tell us about it.
Thank you, Michael. I've got next week Green Flash Jen Schwartman Bar Tour. It was Mike Hinckley's idea. Mike and Lisa are coming out. They're the owners of Green Flash, one of our favorite breweries. And they decided they wanted to tap their beer at all three bars where I work within the course of 1 week.
They love to follow Jen around.
So basically, they're going to follow me around. So on Wednesday, July 6th at Bar 82 from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m., we're going to have two beers. And then Finelli's on Prince and Mercer in Soho on Friday the 8th, we're going to, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
Follow
I can't
Jen
even remember
Swartman.
What my schedule is. We're going to have two different beers. And then the big grand finale is going to be on Sunday the 10th at
Blind Tiger.
Seven beers, a bunch of stuff we haven't
Jen,
had in the city
I know
before.
Your schedule by heart. I'm your biggest fan.
Yeah, you follow
And also, June 29th, Wednesday night, Smutty Nose Brewer David Yarrington will be at Blind Tiger.
Yes, he
That's
will.
That's going to be fun.
Let's give another final shout-out to the July Good Beer Month. We've got some great events. The Great Hot Dog Cook-Off at Kelso Brewery will be on July 23rd. Check out goodbeerseal.com for more information. There's Get Real Belgian Festival, July 8th and 9th. Cookout NYC, which is our event. It's July 10th on Governor's Island. There's also going to be a really special webcast on WNYC on July 15th. So some really cool things. Plus, check out all your local bars. July Good Beer Month.
It's beer season.
Goodbeercenter.com. Yeah. So I'd like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com who have helped to bring this podcast to you and to our supporter, Good Beer Seal. Thanks to Jen, Dave, Penny, and Mike. And a big shout out to Ray Dieter.
Ray Dieter.
I'm Jimmy Carboni.
Cheers,
thanks
Ray.
To our producers, Jack Inslee and Bree O'Connor. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio.
This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This little refrain should help me explain. As a matter of fact, I like beer.
He likes beer.
My wife often frowns when we're out
town. This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. In food safety news this week was an article about the Senate bill, which is addressing antibiotics in animal feed. A bipartisan group of senators reintroduced a bill late last week aimed at preserving the effectiveness of medically important antibiotics by limiting their use in food animal feed. In the face of the rising threat of antibiotic resistance, public health experts and activists have pushed for regulation to limit the subtherapeutic use of antibiotics in animal agriculture. Recent estimates indicate around 80% of all antibiotics in the U.S. are given to food animals. And by the way, those drugs include ones that you're very familiar with. The following antibiotics are routinely used in human medicine and agriculture. Fluoroquinolones, penicillin, tetracycline, erythromycin, lincomycin, tylosin, and virginiamycin. Okay, at least three of those are ones I'm sure we've all taken at one time or another in our lives. Senator Dianne Feinstein from California, the primary sponsor of the Preservation of Antibiotics for Medical Treatment Act, otherwise known as PAMTA, reintroduced the measure to address the, quote, rampant overuse of antibiotics in agriculture that creates drug-resistant bacteria, an increasing threat to human beings. She then went on to say the effectiveness of antibiotics for humans is jeopardized when they are used to fatten healthy pigs or speed the growth of chickens. This is a basic food safety initiative that would phase out the misuse of these drugs so that food in supermarkets across America will not spread strains of drug-resistant bacteria. Susan Collins from Maine, Jack Reed from Rhode Island, and Barbara Boxer from California all collaborated on this legislation. The bill that Feinstein is championing, PAMTA, mirrors a bill introduced by Congresswoman Louise Slaughter from New York, the only microbiologist serving in Congress. The legislation phases out the non-therapeutic use of medically important antibiotics in livestock, requires new applications for animal antibiotics to demonstrate the use of the antibiotics will not endanger public health, and does not restrict the use of antibiotics to treat sick livestock or to treat pets, which is all appropriate. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Check out a small clip from The Food Scene, hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel, a show where food and art intersect.
I think most recently you had a chocolate waterfall that had 5 tons of chocolate flowing, and you'd put on, what, a protective suit, walk through a waterfall, yeah, make your own chocolates within this kind of contained environment. And most recently, a rabbit cafe.
Yep.
Can you explain that one to me a little bit?
Well, and this also slightly comes from jellies as well, because in England, everyone has these rabbit jelly molds. It's the most popular mold. Everyone goes, oh, I had rabbit jellies as a kid. And we've always been utterly bewildered by it. Why rabbit jellies? The only way to get to the bottom of it was to get a whole herd of rabbits, open a cafe with them, and have people touch rabbits and eat.
Yeah.
So it kind of has resonance with one of our favourite cookbooks, which we think an awful lot of modern chefs have is their dark secret under their pillow, which is the futurist.
Want to hear more? Well, tune into The Food Scene live every week, Tuesdays at 3 p.m., or you can find all the archive shows on our website or subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. Thanks for listening. The following is a message from Zingerman's.
From June 30th to July 3rd, 2011, come hang out at Camp Bacon, a four-day festival hosted by Zingerman's. The main event is an all-day affair at Zingerman's Roadhouse featuring plenty of bacon, bacon learning, and such luminaries as Alan Benton, John T. Edge, Molly Stevens, and more. The event will be taking place in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Proceeds from this event benefit Southern Foodways Alliance. Also, on Friday, July 1st, there'll be a special benefit performance featuring Andre Williams and the Gold Stars and special guest John Langford and Skull Orchard. Visit www.zingermanscampbacon.com for more information and for tickets. Once again, that's www.zingermanscampbacon.com.